Welcome to a special bonus episode of Undisclosed. Rabia Chaudhry here. I'm joined with my colleagues Susan Simpson and Colin Miller, and we are doing this bonus episode to cover the most recent appellate hearing in the Adnan Syed case. Hi, Colin, and hello, Susan.
Hey.
Hey, Rabia.
This hearing took place on November 29th, and this hearing was before the Court of Appeals, which is the highest court in Maryland. Just to refresh your memory, the last two courts, the Circuit Court and the Court of Special Appeals, both overturned Adnan's conviction based on different issues. Then they kind of switched out. The state keeps appealing it. So this is, I suppose, kind of the final level of state appeal, right? The final state appeal they can do on these issues. That's it for them?
Theoretically.
Most could be remanded likely. Back down to the Court of Special Appeals, but yeah, probably this is the last stage.
We can't go up again, but we can't go down again.
We can go down again and start it all over. And that would happen if, so there's two issues before this court. One is, of course, the ever-persistent Asia alibi issue and ineffective assistance of counsel in that situation, or whether there's ineffective assistance of counsel because Gutierrez failed to, I guess, the cell tower thing basically was not able to properly cross-examine the state's witness in the cell tower expert. Now, that second issue, I understand that's the issue that could be remanded down, right? Not the Asia issue.
Right, yeah. In the event that the Court of Appeals reverses and finds there was not ineffective assistance in connection with alibi witness Asia McLean, they could find we disagree with the Court of Special Appeals that the cell tower claim was waived. The Court of Special Appeals never got to the merits of that claim because Judge Welch had found that was grounds for a new trial. And so theoretically, the Court of Appeals could say, you lost the alibi claim. There's not waiver of the cell tower claim. Let's remand that back down to the Court of Special Appeals. They can have a new opinion that can go back up to us, and we can have a new opinion. We could be talking about another year or two.
But if they do find that there was ineffective assistance of counsel on the Asia McLean issue, meaning they find for the defense, they find for Adnan, that's it. The second issue would not be remanded down.
Exactly. It wouldn't matter at that point.
All right. Okay. All right. So I'll set up the day. Of course, I was there. Susan was there. It was this past Thursday, November 29th, and we met up before the hearing was to begin at 10 a.m. And there's a bunch of construction happening, so we went through the basement. It was Susan, myself, Meet the Law producer, Justin Brown, and Auntie Shamim, which is Adnan's mom. And I just have to tell people the story because I just have to tell them the story. And this happened actually in the last hearing too, which was so weird. We get in this little elevator, a couple other people already in there. We're kind of, it was fairly crowded, I thought. About to go up to the floor we need to get off on. And as the door closes, suddenly a hand pops in and it's the prosecutor, Thiru Vignaraja. And I think we just all looked at each other like, oh God, I really thought he wouldn't get in the elevator, but he did. Said good morning. And incredibly awkward, stressful few minutes going up. I was a little rude because I couldn't control myself. And I said very loudly, it's going to be a great morning. And I'm so glad I won't be sequestered today so I can see the state get humiliated. It was a nice... It was the nicest thing I had to do.
He has a very friendly tone. I'll give you that. You said it in a very friendly tone.
Yeah, I did. But I, you know, anyway, I just wanted to ruin his morning a little bit, I think. And also, God, I have so much stuff to say to that man.
I can hear Justin Brown quietly screaming, silently screaming next to you.
I had to look back over my shoulder and he was looking at me like, don't do it, Robbie. Don't say anything. Don't do it. But anyway, whatever. Maybe it threw him off a bit. But, you know, Thiru Vignaraja has been prosecuting this case now, I don't know, with 3 years, I think. He has been doing so even after having left the attorney general's office. He has been in private practice the last couple of years. So we have this pro bono prosecutor who is like a dog with a bone and won't let it go. So anyway.
Pro bono prosecutor.
Pro bono prosecutor. Yeah. I mean, rare. Or would you consider this kind of like a special counsel type of appointment? I mean, is that one way to look at it?
No.
I don't get it. No. Okay. Well, I've always wondered about the ethics of that, but forget that for now, because let's talk a little bit about who represented Adnan. It was not Justin Brown. I mean, he was there, you know, sitting at the lawyer's table, but he did not argue for Adnan's side. It was an attorney by the name of Kate Stetson. And Ms. Stetson is a partner at Hogan Lovells, a real big law firm that has been working pro bono on the case for I think about 2 years now. And she's one of the best appellate attorneys in the nation. She is highly regarded in Maryland. She has argued over 85 cases. She's had multiple arguments before the U.S. Supreme Court. She's argued in every single federal circuit except for one in the country. And last year, she was elected a fellow of the American Academy of Appellate Lawyers, which is a really high honor for appellate attorneys. Basically, she is a kick-ass appellate attorney. And this was a stealth move by Justin Brown to shake and rattle the prosecution. Apparently, they did not know until the day of, the morning of. So what'd you guys think of that move?
Oh, she's one of the best of the best. She's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, she was terrific because, you know, sometimes you get someone and they're almost too aggressive in the way that they handle oral arguments. Sometimes you get someone that's almost a robot. They're just there citing law and precedent. She just had a real soothing, calm tone. She just very nicely led the judges through the applicable case law, very straightforward arguments. It was just, it seemed almost effortless, which makes sense given her experience.
Very disciplined.
Yeah. Now, it was live streamed, so I'm assuming a lot of folks got a chance to watch it there. And I think it's, you can still go back and watch it. I think it's still available.
Yeah,
it's archived. Okay.
Stamps.com brings all the services the U.S. Post Office right to your desktop. You can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter, any package, any class of mail using just your own computer and printer. Then the mail carrier picks it up. No trip to the post office required. It couldn't be easier. You can print postage any day, anytime. Stamps.com is always open. And Stamps.com not only saves you time, it saves you money. Stamps.com helps you print the right amount of postage every time, so you never overpay again. And with Stamps.com, you get discounts on postage you can't even get at the post office. With all the time and money you'll save, Stamps.com is the best gift you can give yourself during this holiday season. Now, in addition to my work on Undisclosed, I'm currently working on a case that involves sending and receiving huge amounts of files, and Stamps.com has made my life so easy during this holiday season. And right now, you too can enjoy the Stamps.com service with a special offer that includes a 4-week trial, plus postage, and a digital scale without long-term commitments. Go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in Undisclosed. That's Stamps.com, enter Undisclosed.
Okay, so the Court of Appeals has a panel of 7 judges, and the judges enter the room. It was a pretty diverse panel of judges. I think majority women, a couple of African-American judges. And I think one judge actually came out of retirement for this, right, Colin?
Yeah, so Judge Atkins had retired, I think, in October, but she is, at least for the moment, staying on the bench. And so she was one of the 7 judges deciding this case. And she actually probably asked the most questions during oral arguments to the counsel.
The way it began was the state started, so each side has 30 minutes, right? And they can reserve time for the rebuttal, basically. And that includes the time in which the judges will also question them as they're making their argument. The hearing began with the state presenting their argument first. I thought it was interesting that Theuer just kind of popped up there, no notes in hand, nothing. He just was like winging it. I don't know. Is that unusual to me? It was weird.
Typically, okay. If you're using the notes during an appellate argument, you're doing it wrong.
So you just know your stuff. I don't know. I assumed you'd have something.
Yeah, I bring notes up because I like having them there, but you're not supposed to use them.
Okay. I mean, the entire time, I mean, the focus was on the alibi issue. The cell phone issue came up very briefly. Kate Stetson brought it up very, very briefly. I don't think a single question was asked by any of the judges about it. So the entire focus was on the alibi issue. In Theroux's opening, I think 20 minutes is what he used. A number of arguments he makes. Let's talk about some of them.
His whole theme in 2 words was silent record.
Silent record and per se rule, right? I would say that's a second running theme. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about that, what that means, the silent record argument. Either one of you want to explain
that?
A
tie goes to the state. That was his theory, is that tie goes to the state and this is a tie.
What he was saying was this. He was saying that, you know, when you're trying to figure out why an attorney made a certain decision, because here what we are arguing is that this was not a strategic decision by Gutierrez to not contact Asia McClain. It was basically her just screwing up. The argument he's making is that there's nothing in the record to show why she did or did not contact Asia McClain, hence silent record. Over and over again, he said the record is silent as to why Gutierrez. So what we do is the presumptions in favor of the state. When the record is silent, I don't know, is that even a thing? Is this true, Colin? He was citing to a Supreme Court case, which I'm not familiar with.
It's a real case, but it's not like what he was hinting at real themes and real holdings. It's the application to this case where it starts getting questionable.
Yeah, I have sort of a legal take on this and then a factual take. So the legal take, Robbie, as you know, he's citing these two Supreme Court cases, Cullen versus Pinholster, which they used extensively in their briefs, and then Burt versus Titlow, which was a lot of the focus on oral arguments. And the problem with that is if you look at those cases, we've discussed this law multiple times on the podcast. It is the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act that was passed after the Oklahoma City bombing in the 90s. And both of those cases deal with what's known as the double deference standard, which says if you claim ineffective assistance of counsel in state court and you lose and you're now appealing that in federal court, there's deference given not only to trial counsel, but also to the state court's findings. And in fact, in Cullen versus Pinholster, they even say defendant cites these other cases. They don't really apply because the double deference didn't apply there. Those were not anti-terrorism and effective death penalty cases. And so theory keeps on citing to these cases, but legally speaking, they're not really applicable because this is not a state appeal to federal court. This is in state court, and that double deference standard does not apply. The second part is the factual, where, again, Theo was claiming silent record, and I think Kate Stetson had a good response to this, which is to say, we know a lot in this case. We know that these letters were sent. We know from the notes that Adnan told Gutierrez about Asia McClain well before trial. Those letters had details, such as the video cameras being a possibility, the two other witnesses. In this case, we know there was a trial run. There was a first trial that ended in a mistrial, and so Gutierrez knew exactly what the state's timeline and case was before that second trial, and despite that, she did not contact Asia McClain. And so Kate Stetson's point is this is not factually a silent record. We know a lot about the case. We don't know everything, but we know a lot.
Yeah, and also just to point out in that case, the Supreme Court case we're talking about here, it's not really emphasized in the case itself, but in Titlow, I think it's significant that the issue involves an attorney doing what the client asked versus Anand's case, it's about an attorney not doing what the client asked. That's not part of the holding, but I do think that's a standard that could be taken into consideration here because, so the Titlow case, basically, she took a plea deal, got a plea deal, then rejected it, went to trial and lost badly. And the claim was that the attorney should have told her, hell no, don't go to trial, you're going to lose really badly, and didn't. But this was something she was initiating and in charge of. Like, the plea deal is always, always the final call goes to the client. This is not something the attorney can ever substitute the judgment for. So it's a different setup from here where the client is saying, go check out my alibi. And the attorney's just like, eh, don't worry about it.
Speaking of which, whatever happened to the plea issue in this case?
It's gone. About that.
It's gone. Okay. So I know Judge Houghton, I think, questioned the state about the silent record.
I have a question here from Judge Houghton. You seem to suggest we should draw a rational inference relative to silence in the record on the point. So I want to know what case law you have to support that proposition. That's what then leads Theroux to citing the Burt case from the Supreme Court, which did deal with a silent record. But as Susan noted, in some senses, it's the flip side of the coin in this case, because in that case, it was the client saying, I'm innocent. The attorney says, well, then go to trial, reject the plea deal. And what the court says in that case is that's never going to be unreasonable. If a client's saying they're innocent, it's never unreasonable for the attorney to say, well, take your chances at trial. Here, Adnan has, of course, always said that he is innocent, and that's, in fact, why his plea bargain claim was rejected. But exactly, if the client's claiming they're innocent and they're saying, here's an alibi witness that can prove my innocence, that's where the defense is saying, look, there's this obligation to contact that witness.
One thing I forgot to mention is the state, I think, right out the gate stipulated that there's agreement that nobody's disputing the fact that Asia McClain was never contacted. Like, that's... Which I thought was...
It's weird, because it was never been off the table before, has it?
No. But, you know, hey, thanks for that, is all I'm going to say. I think Judge Atkins also, confirmed that. She said, you know, we were all in agreement that there was never... that she never contacted her. One of the things I noticed with Kate Stetson when she came back and talked about this specific issue was that she didn't really distinguish the facts in the cases he was citing, did she, I think? And when she...
She was very good at not following Theroux's bait.
She seemed highly skeptical. She sat in the middle. She just looked really skeptical every time she questioned Theroux, in my estimation. I could be wrong.
You can never tell. Like, I hate... I mean, sometimes judges ask questions they mean sincerely, and their emotions are sincere. And a lot of the times, judges are just trolling.
Like, you're kidding.
They're just playing with the, you know, it's like cat and mouse. They're batting it around. They don't actually mean they mean the questions, but that doesn't necessarily reflect their internal positions.
She was asking Thiru about whether or not there was actually an investigation of the alibi. And I think Thiru also, he then resorts to kind of like the same arguments we've heard before, is that Gutierrez already knew what Asia was going to say, that it was going to contradict her alibi by routine defense that she was going to use for Adnan, which never actually happened, that Adnan had given contradictory statements to the police and his defense team, so Gutierrez didn't want to touch it. He was giving all the different reasons that he supposed that Gutierrez didn't contact Asia because he thought it would derail Gutierrez's defense. But if I remember correctly, the chief judge was like, that's when she was kind of like skeptical about, she's like, well, how do you even, isn't it kind of, I can't remember, the language was kind of strong. I can't remember what she said, but basically she's kind of like ridiculous to, that she could make any of those decisions without ever actually investigating the alibi. Now, later, I think towards the closing, he also made another argument, which seemed to suggest that Gutierrez did investigate, right?
Not Gutierrez. He said that the first counsel, Chris Fuller.
That they had actually sent witnesses, right?
I mean, he wants it both ways. Thiru, like, both claim that Asia did not need investigated because Anand had never told his attorneys about the library alibi. And then he says, oh, but his first attorneys went to the library, so he did tell them they did check it out. Like, he wants it both ways. Either Anand did tell his attorneys about it, and that counts against him, or he didn't tell them about it, and it counts against him, too.
He also repeatedly kept pressing that Anand himself had said that his routine was school track practice, maybe the library, and by library he meant school library, not the public library, which is of course on the school. One of the judges did ask, though, that wasn't the public library like right there by the school?
She asked, it was across the street, right? And Thiru was like, it was in close proximity because it's in the same like lot, but he didn't want to like give. Yeah
Thiru went to that school. Okay, just so everybody knows, Thiru went to Woodlawn Public High School. Okay.
Article is an online-only furniture company. By eliminating the layers of traditional retail, Article is able to keep prices low and quality high. They have no showrooms and no salespeople, just savings. Article offers beautifully designed modern furniture that's done with Scandinavian simplicity. And Article is serious about shipping. No matter how many items you order, every order is shipped at a flat rate of $49. And if you need some help getting set up, Article has options for in-room delivery and for assembly assistance. Finally, Article is quick and customer first. In-stock items can be expected in 2 weeks or less, and Article offers a 30-day return policy. Now, I can say I recently used Article to buy two Oscura console tables in bronze and walnut that I'm using as plant stands. The website was easy to use, the tables are delivered without a hitch, and the stands look great and are really well built. And now you can try Article too. Article is offering our listeners $50 off their first purchase of $100 or more. To claim, visit article.com/undisclosed. That's all it takes. Go to article.com/undisclosed and the discount will be automatically applied at checkout. That's article.com/undisclosed to get $50 off your first purchase of $100 or more.
The question that Thiru wanted to come down to was the fact that we don't know the actual reason Gutierrez didn't contact Asia. And Kate Stetson's whole point was like, that's the one thing we don't need to know. This is an objective standard here. This is a standard based on what would a reasonable attorney do in that situation. And in Thiru's argument, he like keeps harping on the fact there's this case, the one we were talking about earlier from Supreme Court, where the attorney gave a reason. The attorney explained why they did something in the case. And the reason that he gave was ridiculous. It was a stupid reason that no one would agree with or think was a reasonable, good attorney decision. So the court said, well, okay, like the reason that the attorney's given to us is bullshit, but there were a lot of good, reasonable reasons to do this anyway. And so Thiru cites this case trying to say, hey, look, the court can replace the attorney's judgment with their own. So that means we win. But it's the opposite, because what the court is saying is like, we don't give a shit what the attorney believed. We don't give a shit why the attorney said they did what they did. We're going to look at the objective reasonableness here, which is what Kate Stetson was saying. And under these facts, no, it is not reasonable for attorney not to contact an alibi.
You know, one of the things that kept occurring to me as somebody, I mean, I have never practiced criminal law, is like the argument theory is making, the effect of that would be this. Anytime that an attorney doesn't specifically note somewhere in the record or somewhere else, like later down the line on any kind of record, why they didn't make, because here in this case, Gutierrez is deceased. We cannot, you know, examine her, cross-examine her. But in any case like this where you can't determine for sure, that automatically that means that we have to assume the attorney made. And I would think lots of attorneys, especially attorneys who are not doing their job properly, are not going to actually document why they didn't do what they were supposed to do, especially if it just wasn't on their radar. It didn't occur to them. They were overwhelmed. They just weren't functioning properly. It would be unusual, in fact, during the course of investigation, before the trial, to be like, this is why I'm not doing what I'm not doing.
Especially under Strickland, the worst kind of attorney, like malpractice, is the attorney that's doing nothing. Like the attorney decisions are giving huge difference. Attorneys that decide stuff for a reason, that is pretty sacred under current like IAC law. But attorneys that are asleep at the wheel, they are constitutionally not effective. If they're constitutionally not doing anything, then that's not okay. So in the scenario that's the most problematic under the Constitution, the attorney that's just not there, that's the one that would be immune essentially from review if the attorney's either dead or not able to come to the trial for whatever reason.
Right.
Despite of all Theroux's claims again and again that it is Anand Syed here, he was trying to promote a per se rule. The only per se rule was coming from Theroux. He wants a per se rule where if the attorney doesn't testify, it's game over.
Right.
He tried to soften that up a bit by saying, oh, there's other ways to prove it. But in reality, no. Unless the attorney's up there talking, there's no, how can you know what the attorney thought?
Are you looking to give a really thoughtful gift, especially to somebody who just loves to like, you know, all kinds of audio content? I've got the perfect gift for you. Give them an Audible membership. And right now it's the best time to do it with a special offer. Everybody knows that Audible has an unbeatable selection of audiobooks, includes bestsellers, motivational stuff, mysteries, thrillers, memoirs, everything. You can choose 3 titles every month with this membership. You get an audiobook and then 2 Audible originals, and I love their original series. And you also can't get them anywhere else, by the way. You can listen on any device, anytime, anywhere, at home, on your commute. Mostly, most of my listening, to be honest, is done when I'm doing home chores, when I'm folding laundry, washing the dishes, and driving my children to the million different places they need to go. And you can easily enjoy audiobook exchanges. I'm saying you, but I'm also talking about the person you love who you're going to get this gift for, because you're going to get this gift for somebody you love. All right. Now, for a limited time, you get 3 months of Audible for just $6.95 a month. All right. That's less than $7 a month. And that's more than half off the regular price. So give yourself and give somebody you love the gift of listening and learning even. Now, look, maybe I have a little bit of a bias, but I'm just going to make a recommendation for any of you folks who actually haven't read my book, or, you know, people who have always been interested in the Serial story but have no idea what happened after. Look, hundreds of millions of people listen to Serial, but not all of them have any idea what happened afterwards. I kind of recommend a non-story. I read it myself, okay? I put in all the love, effort that I did in writing the book into reading the book. It was a really emotional experience for me. It has gotten recognition in the audiobook world. It has been very popular. And so I'm going to be that terrible person. I'm going to recommend my own book because I think, you know, the story isn't over. Anand's appeal hearings are ongoing. There is a documentary that's going to be coming out on HBO, a documentary series, in fact, coming out on HBO. And there's a lot that's happened in the last 4 years. So also, by the way, Anand's letters, his own letters are in there. They're letters that we wrote to each other over the course of 17 years. And there are letters he wrote just for the book. So check out Adnan's story on Audible. I promise you won't regret it. And if you do, you can tweet at me and just be angry at me and then exchange it for something you want. But I guarantee you're going to like it. If you like my voice in your ear, you're going to like the book. For more, go to audible.com/undisclosed, or you can text the word undisclosed to the number 500-500-500-500. Again, right now, for a limited time, you get 3 months of Audible for just $6.95 a month. What a great gift. That's more than half off the regular price. Just go to audible.com/undisclosed or text the word undisclosed to 500-500 to get started. So let's talk about the per se rule and why this issue kept coming up over and over. And it's tied also to, so the Maryland Public Defenders Association, which is all the public defenders in the state, I guess, you know, represents them. They filed an amicus in support of Adnan's side. And in that brief, they make the argument that for an attorney not to contact an alibi witness, just not even to make contact, is unreasonable, right? Like, it's not considered a reasonable thing for an attorney to do, meaning, like, so then that person is constitutionally ineffective in their duty to represent their client. What Theroux was saying is that what this brief is arguing, and by extension what the defense is arguing, is that anytime this happens, like, there should be a per se rule that anytime this happens, per se, there's ineffective assistance of counsel, right? That's the argument he's making, I think. But Colin, I'll let you explain it better.
Yeah, that's exactly it, is that he is arguing both in the amicus brief, as well as, I think he said, pages 20 and 28 of the defense's brief, that they're arguing for a per se rule. And so my first thought on that is, if you look to the defense brief, specifically on page 20, that's not what they're arguing for. They say, you know, generally there's this obligation to investigate and contact an alibi witness who's raised by the defendant, but that the prosecution can rebut that finding, that it's ineffectiveness, and can point to other evidence to show why it made sense not to contact this witness. So I would say the defense is certainly not arguing for a per se rule. The second point is, I'm just not sure why the state and Theroux were harping on this, because the court is not obligated to adopt the argument by the defense. So they could very easily find there's not a per se rule and yet still find, under the circumstances of this case, where there was notice of Asia months before trial and there's this whole dress rehearsal of the first trial, she's local, she gives a phone number, she mentions other witnesses, they could easily find in this case there was an obligation. And so I don't know why he spent so much time in his initial argument and then his rebuttal harping on, you know, it's per se rule and this per se rule can't apply. I think he should have focused more time saying, here are reasons why in this case there was not an obligation to contact Asia McClain. So I'm not sure why he spent so much time on that.
Well, can I first ask, what would the issue be with a per se rule legally? Why is that problematic?
The idea under Strickland is, I don't want to, like, artificially, like, crib in attorneys, artificially impose, like, rules that on the ground, in the moment, don't make sense. And in general, that's a good strategy. I'm not arguing for a per se rule, but I wouldn't really mind a per se rule here, because I think that the situation, it balances out on the prejudice prong. Even if you found it was per se unreasonable not to contact an alibi witness,
right,
it's still not going to matter unless it was material to the defense. So in cases where the attorney, like, reasonably didn't contact the witness, that's probably going to go to prejudice. It's probably because there was nothing to help the case there.
As Susan says, it's kind of not really relevant in the end because you have the prejudice prong. But, you know, imagine a case where it's a public defender and right before trial is starting, you have the defendant saying, I've been telling you this story, but here's this alibi I have. They live across the country and they kind of give a kind of shaky story. And this person has drug problems and convictions. You know, you can imagine in that case, the court not wanting a per se rule, because you could imagine maybe a scenario where contacting the alibi witness doesn't have to be done for it to be reasonable performance. But yeah, I agree with Susan. I wouldn't really mind a per se rule, but I don't think the defense was arguing for one. And I don't think the court has to accept it.
Or take the classic example. The client says, hey, I got a friend. He'll give me an alibi of some sort. Just go talk to him. He'll make one up. Then there's no obligation to contact that witness.
Right. Or wouldn't a per se, or there seem to be scenarios in which a per se rule should just clear, like, you know, let's say attorney shows up intoxicated at trial. I mean, you know, I mean, or whatever, you know, I mean, like, I feel like there have to be certain scenarios where, like, it's
hey,
so
attorney
clear.
Calling asleep is fine.
Oh,
well, not
okay.
Fine, but also not per se unconstitutional.
Well, kind of the bottom line on this, though, is this, we have this classic case, Strickland versus Washington, I think 1984 out of the Supreme Court. And what they specifically say in that case is it really shouldn't be per se. It should be based on the facts of each given case and this whole reasonableness analysis. And so that's kind of why courts are loath to do that, as the Supreme Court itself has said, we don't want per se rules in most cases.
It doesn't, yeah. Well, Kate Stetson repeatedly repudiated that. She said, we are not asking for a per se rule. We are saying that by the objective standards, you know, Strickland calls to, you know, to inquire into the objective reasonableness of counsel's performance, and that's what we are asking to do. And then she laid out why objectively in any case, like, you know, Gutierrez's conduct was unreasonable because she had noticed many months before trial, because she had a second shot at trial, because it wasn't just Asia, it was other alibis, plus a camera in the library. There were so many ways she could have corroborated this alibi. I mean, like, she gave, you know, plus Asia gave a number. She gave, I mean, like, it was, And her client himself numerous times said, you know, mentioned to the team that there is an alibi. It appears in the notes. And then she also mentioned that after the conviction, and I remember this happening, Adnan contacting Gutierrez, and I can't remember if it was a letter, because I remember helping his, well, I drafted a letter on his parents' behalf saying, did you not contact this person? Adnan had a conversation over the phone with Gutierrez. I had written a letter, and then her response was like, no, I didn't contact them, and there's nothing you can do about it now. If you want to make sure nothing comes between you and protecting your family this holiday, you need the Simply Safe home security system. Winter is upon us, but if a storm takes out your power, Simply Safe is ready. If an intruder cuts your phone line, Simply Safe has it covered. Say they destroy your keypad or siren, Simply Safe will still get you the help what you need. Look, maybe it sounds like overkill, and maybe it's the last thing you want to think about this holiday, but with Simply Safe, you're always ready. And it's important to always be ready because nobody ever expects to be hurt in their own home. Simply Safe believes that nothing should get between you and protecting your family, and that's why they do not cost an arm and a leg, all right? They could charge that much, but they don't. They charge you what's fair, what's right. Only $14.99 a month. Folks, that is the cost of, like, a movie ticket. Maybe. Sometimes they cost more. There's no contract. There's no markups. There's no installation window. It is so easy. You'll have it up and running in minutes. And I really do recommend Simply Safe to anybody I know who is looking for a good home security system. So today you can save hundreds of dollars on that protection if you go to simplisafeundisclosed.com. Once again, that's Simply Safe. It's spelled SimpliSafe, undisclosed.com. All right? SimpliSafeundisclosed.com. Make sure to use that URL because that's how they know that we sent you. But hurry up because the holiday offer is ending soon. Check out simplisafeundisclosed.com and give your family the most important gift they could ever have, safety.
So in terms of other questions, let's see. We had Judge Watts. So Judge Watts, I think a lot of people on Twitter, as well as myself, thought that she seemed more inclined for the state than any other judge. And so she was asking about whether Asia McClain had flaws as an alibi witness. She's asking about whether the alibi was inconsistent with the story that Adnan had told to the police officers. And so out of the seven judges, she was the one that, you know, you never know, but I would probably put firmly in the camp of likely to rule in favor of the state. Is that the impression that you two got?
Yeah, that's probably a fair assessment. Although also, I just want to know, how is anything, like, how is it contradicting the alibi that he was at the library during that time period? Because it doesn't, I mean, this goes back to, of course, the whole claim about what Adcock said, the officer he talked to that night. But it's not inconsistent to say at some point he was at the library.
Right. There's no inconsistency there. But also, you know, I thought it was interesting. I almost felt like she was like throwing through bones. Like, hey, how about make this argument? he did not bring up the sisters. I thought that was interesting. For people who forget, he had filed, I think, these affidavits by these sisters, these twin sisters, in the last round of appeals, saying that they remember Asia telling them that she would offer to falsify an alibi for Adnan.
That was not proper time for it.
Yeah, he wouldn't be allowed to raise that because that was not officially allowed in the appellate record. And so he would be prohibited from actually mentioning what they had to say in the case.
I hate that the Juwan argument he brings up is the worst because he already fooled one judge with this. Theo has this argument that Gutierrez was reasonable for not contacting Asia because she had these police notes that could have made her think that this was a fake alibi offer. First of all, those notes were not available to Gutierrez. They were obtained at 2014 through an MPIA request. In 99 and 2000, Gutierrez never saw them. So he did convince the dissent in the COSA opinion that this could be why Gutierrez didn't contact. But it's factually flawed because the time is working. But also, that's not what the notes say. The whole argument is flawed because it is very clear from context that is not what the notes are about. And you can tell that most obviously because if a witness actually told two homicide detectives, hey, your defendant you arrested for murder, try to get me to give a false alibi, they're going to ask about it. They don't. It's factually false, and he's fooled judges before. Hopefully these judges aren't fooled.
Right. I mean, the substance of the argument is not accurate, but also Gutierrez would have to have a time machine because he did that a couple different times. I think he also made some argument. I can't remember another argument about information she wouldn't have had until like later in the trial, and saying that at the time she was tasked to investigate before trial, she already had that information. And that's the same thing he's doing here. He's saying, well, she, because the thing is, even if what he's saying is actually true, again, this is not information anybody knew for years. Gutierrez certainly didn't have it. She could not have used information she didn't have to make a strategic decision. Simple as that. Other questions, Colin, what do you think?
Yeah, well, my favorite question was by Chief Judge Barbera, where she asks, what do you make of Griffin versus Warden, a case upon which counsel relies upon in this case, would seem to suggest a contrary outcome to the one you propose here. And I like that because this is the case, I think it was like 4 years ago now, I posted about, was sort of my last blog post in the wake of the initial Serial podcast, where I was saying, I think Adnan is eventually going to win on this issue. And yeah, I mean, here's the chief judge of the court basically asking the state, how do you distinguish this case? By the way, Griffin versus Warden, it's from the United States Court of Appeals from the Fourth Circuit, which is the federal court that covers Baltimore. The case actually originated out of Baltimore. And, you know, Theo tried again to distinguish this case, but really it's very similar. And I would say, again, more favorable Adnan's case than this one, because that's the case where the attorney didn't contact an alibi witness in a robbery. And in fact, one of the victims of that robbery had identified this alibi witness as a possible perpetrator. And yet still the Fourth Circuit is saying, look, you had an obligation to contact this alibi witness, see what they had to say. And so that, I still think at the end of the day in the Court of Appeals, I expect that Griffin case to be front and center. And I think Chief Judge Barbera sort of foreshadowed that with this question that she asked.
And Theo said, like, I think Griffin should be overturned,
mm-hmm.
which, okay, cool, but these guys can't do that.
So Colin, you've now written 5 blog posts about the proceedings. So what other issues did you cover in your blog posts?
Well, I think we covered the first 4. The last one is the 5th blog post I just did this morning on December 3rd, which is the cell tower claim. And the significance here really is that it wasn't significant, that the state didn't mention it at all. Kate Stetson spent about 2.5 minutes on her argument, arguing it to the judges. They didn't ask any questions. When she was reserving her time after that 2.5 minutes, she just made sure any questions about the cell tower claim, there weren't. And I think that clearly, again, would indicate the judges really aren't interested in this argument. I can't really see that being anything that's going to guide their decision in favor of the defense. And so I think we're really on the alibi issue. I think that's going to decide who wins this appeal.
So I feel confident on the law here. It's in Adnan's favor. Kate's arguments were just better on that front too. And I will say, this is like the one time, and Theo is usually a pretty strong appellate arguer. This case, he seemed, at least in the second round, at least when he went back up there, he seemed a bit flustered to me, more so than before. Usually he's much calmer, and he seemed almost frantic, and I couldn't tell why, really, given the questions he was getting. But the law was in Adnan's favor. What concerns me still is what appellate courts can always do, which is interpret facts in creative ways to help the outcome they think should happen.
And I feel like that could happen on the prejudice prong of this, right?
Well, hardly brought up prejudice at all, which I found very strange. And not even just the judges. It was also Theo didn't bring it up. But they did mention at one point the earlier decision from the trial court where he found that based on the letters, Gutierrez could have reasonably thought that Asia was an offer to lie.
That was the one judge, that same judge who...
Yeah, and I could see room for a justice to like thread through some needles there and claim that even if Asia was a factually important alibi, a reasonable attorney might have somehow concluded that this was an offer to lie and not have had a constitutional obligation to follow up, even if that conclusion was shaky and undermined by the evidence.
Yeah, and that is one thing I did want to note too, following up on Susan's point is, yeah, Kate Stetson, her argument cited to this key Michael Skakel case out of Connecticut, the Kennedy relative. Recently, after the Court of Special Appeals ruled, they had this long string cite, a cite of cases from across the country, and said, in all our research, we haven't found a single case where the failure to contact an alibi witness was found to be non-prejudicial. And she cited to that. And then Theroux, when he was trying to respond to that, I think misconstrued the argument and said, well, I don't sure how much research the Supreme Court of Connecticut did, but we found plenty of cases where it was found to not be deficient performance to fail to contact an alibi witness. Now, I would dispute his characterization of those cases, but that wasn't her point, and that wasn't the court's point. The point was on the prejudice prong, whether this would have changed the outcome at trial, not on the deficient performance prong about whether the witness should have been contacted. And so Yeah, at the very end, as Susan noted, when he was sort of rushing through at the end of his rebuttal argument, did like throw in, well, there's these eyewitnesses and accomplice and all that. Yeah. But he was really rushing, was kind of jumbled. And so he really didn't address prejudice much in his argument at all.
He wanted to make this referendum on guilt or innocence, which it's not. Yeah. Like, he wanted this to be like, your honors, look how guilty Anand is. Don't worry about the law. He's guilty. So factor that into your decision. But this just isn't what is going on right now. I mean, guilt or innocence doesn't matter for Anand. Not at this stage, not in this kind of proceeding.
It's not supposed to.
But it always is.
What do you guys think? Do you think there's any, would the judges consider, for example, I mean, Judge Welch got to see Asia testify in person. He made in his order, you know, found her to be credible. Is that something they would take into consideration?
Yeah. And so that would be a factual finding by Judge Welch, who got to see Asia in person, her demeanor, and not just sort of see her written testimony in a transcribed record. And so any factual findings by Judge Welch are not going to be reversed unless they are clear error, which means, in essence, the state can't win on any factual arguments to the contrary. They're pretty much going to rubber stamp what Judge Welch found, factually speaking.
Okay. So general sense here, we feel good.
I always feel worried.
Looking at the judges and the arguments and the questions, I'm thinking 5-2 in favor of Adnan on the alibi claim.
I love your predictions, Colin. I love your predictions because they're always on point.
Going 5-2 for the defense.
The arguments went really well. They did, but to I'm not going to chance fate and make a prediction. I'll leave it to Colin.
So what next? About how long do we think this is going to take? What I understand is that it can take as late as August 2019, right? That's kind of like an upper limit.
August is the end of like max date, 2019.
Yeah. That's the Judge Barbera court with her as chief. They pretty much stick to deadlines. Their deadline is August 31st. I was looking through recent opinions, and most of them came about 2 to 3 or 4 months after oral arguments. I asked Steve Klepper, who's an expert in Maryland appellate law, and he said that's probably for a more clear-cut unanimous opinion. He's expecting around May of 2019, so that makes sense to me. I would say around April or May of 2019, we'd expect the opinion.
Like, they're not going to work on it until January, just because no one works in December. And they're going to make sure this is a very carefully written opinion. So I would say it's at the longer end. I would say like June.
So they actually work through the summer? Like, we expect opinions that come out during the summer as well?
Yep. Yeah, there were opinions that came out in June and July.
The one question I've been asked a couple times is, like, does Adnan have to stay in prison until all this is? Yes, he can't. He doesn't get to come home. Well, I mean, we could reapply for bail, but it wouldn't matter. It wouldn't work. So there's no point. So he's going to have to wait till all this is over. So let's say possible outcomes, right? The possible outcome, one is that they affirm on the Asia issue and again, order a new trial. How long does the state have to decide whether or not they're going to go to trial, put this on the docket, or offer something? Like, can they drag that out forever, scheduling a trial?
Yeah, the courts in Maryland have found there is a right to a speedy trial, but they found that that right and the deadlines that come with it do not apply when it is a conviction that's been thrown out and it's a retrial. So there is a certain deadline, but it's not as fixed as it would be after a person's initially charged.
It's more like a suggestion.
Yeah.
It's a suggestion. What is that suggestion? 6 months, a year? Do we know?
Hopefully not, but it can and has.
That's tragic. That's awful. Yeah. All right. Hopefully that's not what the state decides to do. I cannot imagine them going back to trial. But anyway, you never know. You never know with these guys. All right. Well, thank you guys so much. I guess if there's nothing else. But if folks do have more questions, you can tweet them at us if there's something we didn't cover. And maybe we can respond on Twitter or bring it up in the next addendum or something. And I guess that's it. That's a wrap. And make sure to check out Colin's 5 blogs on the hearing.
Thanks for listening to this special episode of Undisclosed. I'd like to thank the following people: Hannah McCarthy for editing, Christy Williams for website management, Baluki for our logo design, and Mital Telhan, our executive producer. I'd like to thank our sponsors. Promotional details for our sponsors are in the show notes and on our website under the new sponsor page. As always, you can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram using the handle @UndisclosedPod. And finally, you can become a patron and get access to additional content by going to patreon.com/undisclosed.